trash bag was on fire. This bag of all the used booties was on fire. And the rope that attaches my sled to the gang line and my snow hook ropes were burning. So. Oh.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else the Iditarod and whether it even continues. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get canceled, how about we squeeze in at least one more word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod 2020 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media, and today it's a production from out of my apartment. It's Saturday, I'm working from home, and I am coming to you from under a table. The table has a comforter draped over the top, there are some pillows inside, and this is all a lot more about my childlike desire to make a pillow fort and avoid going into an actual workplace, less about my anxiety over the coronavirus. But hey, if you're working from home or hiding under a table and that helps, why not? It's like a little radio studio in here, actually. I've also been led to believe that a table will protect me in the event of a nuclear attack, so it works. It's a pretty thick table, you know, and it, like I said, it's got these pillows in here. This table, it actually has a sticker on it that says that it was made by inmates at a correctional institution. And speaking of correctional institutions, we are an institution that corrects our errors. We said yesterday that Thomas Warner was from Denmark. He is not. He's from Norway. Correction. Anyway, the Iditarod continues to grapple with effects to the race from concern over the spread of coronavirus. Like I said yesterday, Alaska just announced its first positive test a couple days ago. We have only heard about that one positive test, but communities across the state, you know, especially those rural ones along the Iditarod Trail route, they're taking extra precautions, and the ones along the Iditarod are actually limiting the race's access to communities. We have much more on that coming up from Alaska Public Media's reporter on the trail, Zachariah Hughes. I also talked more about those issues with Iditarod CEO Rob Urbach today. It seems like this coronavirus situation, its impacts on different aspects of our lives, is evolving on a daily basis. I reached out to him to just get the latest. We'll also have a report on the weather from a pilot on the trail, because if you haven't heard, there's a storm a-coming, and Alaska bush pilots keep a pretty close eye on the weather, so good people to ask about that. Oh, and by the way, current Iditarod frontrunner Jessie Royer's sled caught on fire for a little while. No big deal. She's okay. The sled's okay. The dogs are okay. No, it wasn't catching on fire because she was going so fast. She's going plenty fast, though. More on that coming up. Also looking forward to an annual Iditapod feature we like to call Snack Attack with Ben and Zach, because it rhymes. That's right, Snack Attack is back. And of course, there will be a listener question that we will attempt to answer and a dog profile. But the big news for the Iditarod, of course, and everybody else probably, is coronavirus. So even before we have an update on the racing that's going on in the last great race, we're going to jump right into that. That is because out on the trail, the Iditarod is struggling to adjust as schools, towns, and checkpoints along the final third of the trail, places that are normally excited and very welcoming as the Iditarod comes through, they're limiting their involvement with the event. And that has major consequences for everybody involved, especially the mushers. They're out there having to modify their plans for racing a very critical and competitive stretch of trail, really known for its harsh conditions. Here's Zach with that story.
News kept emerging Friday about new closures affecting the event. The Bering Strait School District said it would be closing its facilities to visitors, including those associated with the Iditarod. The checkpoint at the community of Nalato has been moved out of town and down onto the nearby river. A handwritten sign duct-taped to the wall at the checkpoint in Galena advised mushers they can expect veterinarians and supplies, but nowhere inside to sleep. Organizers are also asking that fans not make any non-essential travel to the Nome finish, particularly those from out of state. Then, late Friday evening, the Iditarod announced that, exercising a caution regarding COVID-19, the checkpoint in the coastal town of Shaktulik will be shutting down altogether in the interest of public health. So it fell on race judge Karen Ramstead to get a Sharpie, some cardboard, and scribble another note.
I'm just making a sign advising mushers that their supplies will be just outside of Shaktulik for them, but they will not have any race personnel they're available to them.
Ramstead is herself a musher. She ran the race 11 times, and many competitors greet her by name when they pull off the Yukon River into the checkpoint next to Galena's community hall. But she had the unenviable job of breaking the news to them about the new developments, like when Lance Mackey arrived.
Hey, Lance, how's it going?
Hey, I got some news for you that you may want to hear before you factor your plans out. Check Tulik's not going to be a checkpoint anymore. What they've done is there would be a restock supply. All your heat straw and your food drops will be at Old Shaktulik, 2 miles this side of Shaktulik. There will be no race personnel there at all, though.
Oh, that's a little different.
Isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so just so you can start spinning the wheel. Yep.
And we just got the nickel or Nilotto news of the last one, so
who knows what you'll get.
I was
there.
Just going to say, surprise, surprise.
Yep.
For mushers, this is bad news. The stretch up the coast from Unalakleet past Shaktulik to Koyuk is notoriously windy, unpredictable, and harsh. Not having a checkpoint there means not having many options for shelter if conditions become extreme. Yor Olsen was processing the news in Galena as he snacked on an egg roll.
That definitely makes it a little interesting being at that location. It's a safety checkpoint from weather and somewhere to get out of the wind and out of the elements on a long run from Unalakleet to Koyuk. So it's nowhere really out there unless you get out to that shelter cabin, but that's really exposed. And in bad weather, you can't get there. So hopefully we have good weather and a nice trip over.
That's another problem. There's a storm warning for the region in effect until Sunday morning. The severity is an open question, but it's still far from ideal. This is part of the race, though. Mushers are expected to be able to adjust to new variables, even novel ones like these. Paige Drobny says she feels prepared for long, unsupported runs in extreme conditions from her experience on the Yukon Quest.
As a Quest musher, you're out for 200 miles at a time with no checkpoint, so I can camp on the side of the trail all the way to Nome, and that's totally fine with me. I mean, it's a long way, you know, like especially with weather and stuff, between shelter cabins, but what are you going to do, you know?
The Iditarod says it's coordinating with the state of Alaska's chief medical officer to prevent the potential spread of the coronavirus and is paring down its staff along the trail to only essential personnel. In Galena, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
This all comes, as we reported earlier, after the Iditarod canceled its awards banquet and Meet the Mushers event for the end of the race in Nome. The Iditarod Trail Committee also sent a press release yesterday saying that while they appreciate the, quote, passion and social energy of the Iditarod Nation, they're asking that people not considered essential to the race not travel to the Nome finish, in particular, anybody traveling from outside of Alaska. If you're wondering, they defined essential personnel as veterinarians, logistics and communications staff, and, quote, unquote, necessary dog handlers. Which makes me think that they maybe are sending other dog handlers home and kind of limiting that, paring things down. The statement goes on to say the Iditarod hopes people who had plans to travel to Nome will be able to attend the postponed awards banquet in the future, and they're going to notify folks when that is officially rescheduled. No word on that yet. The thing I've been wondering about, though, is what about the race? Things are changing on a daily basis. We've seen all the major professional sports cancel or postpone their seasons. And while the Iditarod is obviously very far down the trail at this point, it seems tough to pull the plug. Like Zach said, it's going to be tough out there on the coast with less opportunity for shelter, probably other complications that we're not even thinking about at this point. So are they discussing canceling the race? Here's my conversation with Iditarod CEO Rob Urbach about that.
We have an amazing race unfolding before us. We're sort of bracing for a storm tonight, troubleshooting some communication issues, but overall, you know, it is shaping up to be one of our best races.
Hey, the main thing I wanted to ask you is, has there been any talk about just canceling the race at this point? Has that come up, and how has that discussion gone?
It has not. We have been in a regular communication with the chief medical officer, Alaska Health and Human Services, we have had these conversations since well before the race started. We have hypervigilant protocols. Arguably, the race itself is the embodiment of social distancing. We now have reconfigured checkpoints away from villages. Almost everybody out on the trail has been in Alaska from some time, or to the best of my knowledge, there has been no community transmission. Nevertheless, nobody is probably completely riskless in the world right now, and we're acutely aware of that, but we have not had that conversation.
I mean, considering that there have been these changes and you know, some of the checkpoints have been kind of moved outside the communities, are you concerned about musher safety, dog safety, from maybe a lack of sort of those facilities, that sort of shelter that you would have expected?
You know, the spirit of the Iditarod is one of ingenuity. And, you know, in talking in regular communications with everybody on the trail, we will not compromise safety for dogs or people. And we have made all the necessary changes and to fortify our ranks to ensure that we maintain the highest standards of dog care and safety and for our people as well. So while some of this has been, involving some extra time and resource deployment, I'm telling you, my leadership style is to empower, and we're really empowered in the field to garner resources. I think that Alaska was built on the backbone of sort of the survivalist mentality, and it's just one more challenge that was thrown at us and an opportunity for our team to excel. You know, if you remember, the Iditarod has been going on for a long time, of course, and back in the day, we operated this without satellite phones and internet access and really essential communications and with a lack of a robust Air Force. So things have advanced so much that we are highly confident that we'll continue to maintain our standards of safety for all in our community.
Can you just tell me kind of what these changes to the checkpoints actually look like out on the ground? Like, are we talking tents and what else? I mean, how what does that actually look like?
Well, I think there are, each checkpoint is different. There are various facilities and cabins that were abandoned that are outside of the traditional community areas that we are using as housing. We'll use yurts. We'll use a combination of everything that we can to further isolate ourselves from the community. And of course, we have flown in ample supplies of disinfectants and wipes and spray bottles. My hunch is we have an excess that we'll leave behind for the communities to use. But it's in essence just utilizing secondary locations that are not the main schools or community centers.
And I guess I just need to ask, I mean, it sounds like you're in close consultation with state health officials, and in terms of any discussion of canceling the race, if they say that's the thing to do, I mean, is that what's going to end up happening?
Things can change minute by minute.
That was Iditarod CEO Rob Urbach, and I have to admit, I had a little trouble with that recording toward the end. Working from home, using some new software, excuses. He went on to say that if the Iditarod gets any new information from state health officials, maybe, evidence that the virus is spreading in Alaska, something like that, they would certainly reassess their decision to keep the race going. Another thing I really wish had been recorded there, Urbach told me that the Iditarod has even reached out to health officials about getting coronavirus test kits to put in the musher sleds to take to Nome, which, is like a connection to the historic 1925 serum run in which mushers relayed a life-saving diphtheria serum to the community. The new Disney movie about that out now, Togo. I don't know how seriously anybody is taking that, but that's what he said, I promise. So the Iditarod continues to mush on toward Nome, and now it's time for a quick race update, finally. As I'm recording this, Jesse Royer's team is just approaching the village of Kaltag at about 630 miles into the race. Brent Sass is about 8 miles behind Royer and trailed another 8 miles back by Norwegian Thomas Warner. Then there's reigning champ Pete Kaiser, along with veteran mushers Aaron Burmeister and Wade Mars behind them in that order. Now, Warner, Burmeister, and Mars have all taken that 8-hour layover that's required somewhere along the Yukon River, so I would expect them to be out in front sometime soon, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. For now, Jessie Royer continues to mush down the Yukon River in first place, and she was of course the first to reach the Yukon and the checkpoint town there of Ruby, but during her trip from Cripple towards Ruby, she had a new experience. Her sled caught on fire, and as she rested her dogs in Galena, she explained what happened.
I was had one of the heat bottles from the cooker I always keeping everything together in a trash bag, you know, empty bottles and stuff. And one of the empty bottles was apparently on fire in maybe inside the bottle, and I didn't see it because I put the bottle in my trash bag. And then I was up here doing chores with the dogs, and then when I walked back, the trash bag was on fire. This bag of all the used booties was on fire, and the rope that attaches my sled to the gang line and my snow hook ropes were burning. So I was like, oh, raced back there and put it all out and had to fix a couple of the ropes and whatnot. But I mean, it didn't hurt anything too much. It was pretty much all fixable, but it was like, ah, flames going everywhere. Just there's snow everywhere. Never a dull moment. Never a dull moment, huh, Coulter? That was something.
Never a dull moment. And that includes the weather in Alaska, almost never dull. Here's Zach with a pilot he only identified to me as Pilot Woodson.
Why can't we fly, Woodson?
Just as a reduced visibility with some snow and overcast skies and flat light.
So what are we looking at right now?
Just some kind of light snow. It's kind of coming and going, and just generally kind of overcast layer, which makes for pretty flat light, not able to distinguish the horizon.
Is the issue here, or is it in, like, Unalakleet and over Caltag and stuff?
It's more so further down on the Yukon and on the coast. The weather here is improving, but down at Nulato and Caltag and Unalakleet especially, just snowing, and the temperature's warmed up quite a bit, too, so a lot wetter, more moisture.
Okay, now that we've talked about all the important stuff, here's a question nobody is asking or maybe cares about. What are Zach and KNOM's Ben Matheson eating out on the trail? Or rather, what were they eating a couple days ago? With all the other news going on, I've found it very difficult to fit this somewhat long installment of Snack Attack into the podcast. But we love Snack Attack, and here again is Snack Attack with Ben and Zach.
With Ben and Zach. Ben, what time is it?
Snack Attack with Zach and Ben.
And we decided that we would catalog our snacks in keeping with our traditional I Did a Pod segment. What do you have, Ben?
This is my cache of supplies, which include 3 cans of cold brew coffee, organic from Fred Meyer, 4 bagels, 3 disgusting packets of ramen.
These look old.
Soy sauce flavored, and different brand soy sauce flavored, and beef flavored. I have no intention of eating these. These are if things really go poorly.
Oh, you don't have Kind Bars in the Kind Bar box. It's a box for Kind Bars, but you just pulled out Oreo Thin Bites.
These are like the most expensive granola bars I've ever bought in my life, and I ate them all within whatever day this is, 3 or 4. So Kind Bars are gone. It's not just a cardboard box I carry around. I've got a gift for you, Zach. It's one of these cans of cold brew coffee.
Wow, thanks, Ben. You gave me one of these last year. We traded. This is great. Thank you. So, Ben, it looks like your snack game really sucks this year. Or, like, this looks like sort of accidental snack package, not optimal or very intentionally thought through. Is that fair of me to say?
I really like to eat food along the trail because it's actually a pretty rich food environment. In McGrath, I was at the Roadhouse eating hamburgers and eating eggs. And in Takotna, I'm eating hamburgers and pie and beef stew and all these things. So it's really more of like a backup in case you've got a night at 30 below and you need to eat some beef jerky and cheese sticks and have some cold brew coffee, as well as snacks that you bought for work, and then you know, a little like 100 calorie packs of Oreo Thins. So it's really more of a backup situation than it is anything else. I don't know why I chose soy sauce flavor. I believe it was my reptile brain that chose soy sauce flavor top ramen instead of something like chicken. Also, when I was at the store, this is when people are starting to shop very heavily for, you know, their coronavirus stash. So there's a limit on the number of ramen items you could buy. Limit's 5. There was also no wet wipes, hand sanitizer, or anything except for the ones that I bought. When there's one canister left at Fred Meyer, I believe it was like natural wet wipes. The active ingredient is vinegar.
Nobody thinks that's killing the coronavirus.
I haven't used any of them.
Well, I didn't mean to be talking trash about your snack game from a position of power. My game was also off this year. We have the clementines, little oranges. These are great. A bunch of Starbucks Via packs. Help yourself. You can take 2. 2 Vias is 1 cold brew in the traditional snack math.
Thank you.
I have the cup of noodles, chicken, all 3. 3 cups of noodles, dried mango. I haven't cracked that open yet. We can have that now, actually. That's a good snack for now.
Can we just describe the color of this mango? What color is a beautiful mango when you see, when you get one in, you know, Central America?
Green.
The inside of it?
I want to say orange.
They're supposed to be orange. This mango, Zach, is a combination of gray and yellow.
I think that's because of all the sugar. These are like not the like healthy shoe leather ones that are all organic and smooth that you get. These ones are full of, you know, aftermarket sugar additives. They're mostly sugar. So, but have one, please. I also have Snickers bars. Pilot Rob has been helping himself to those, which is okay. That's fine. There's just a lot less of them. There are Zone bars. Those are high protein. I have Kind bars, but I packed 2 duffel bags in a really dumb way of packing my things, and so some of my snacks are in duffel bag B, which is in the plane's belly pod, and those are probably frozen solid by now. I have Mountain House chili mac with beef, and then another Mountain House
sweet and sour pork.
Yeah, I've never tried any of these, but I figured... I liked the point that you made, and we've gotten questions on the podcast this year about what the differences are between the northern and southern route, and I would say this has nothing to do with the mushers, but as a sort of like trail groupie following things around, the northern route is easier to eat on. There are more stops where you can purchase food or make donations and eat pretty well. And I'm like you. I mean, I'm relying on these as something to snack on in the plane, but this is not where my main source of calories is coming from.
2017, we went into the checkpoint, which is on the northern route, Galena. And do you remember what Galena checkpoint is known for, or at least was, according to Tim?
Hospitality?
It was the bacon checkpoint. Tim's like, we do everything with bacon. So that's just to underscore the point that there's a lot of food along this northern route, and as long as you've got a pocket full of cash for that donation bin, you can eat pretty well.
I have a pocket full of cash donations, and then I usually have a pocket full of clementines, Kind bars, Snickers, and trail mix.
I think I know where you got the inspiration for that sack full of cuties.
I take this every year.
I think Pilot Rob taught you and taught me that the sack of cuties is good to bring along, because when they freeze,
they only get sweeter.
Bingo.
Yeah, that was a total pilot Rob. I think I brought apples the first year, and they froze, and they hurt to eat, and they tasted like mealy garbage when they thawed. So now it's only clementines. They're also really handy. You can throw them to Pilot Chris or Pilot Lyle, and all of the pilots just accept them and immediately eat them. They're a good thing to share.
About 10 o'clock this morning, I ripped open this bag of beef jerky, which cost me $16, by the way. I told Pilot Rob, this probably isn't very good, but would you like to try some? Assuming that he would say no. His answer was, beef jerky is always good, and they ate a handful.
Pilot Rob ate approximately $5.50 worth of beef jerky for breakfast. All right, would you drum us out?
Oh, wait, I forgot the actual beat, which is...
Stack Attack with Ben and Zach. Zach and Zach, Ben.
Okay, that's enough. Quite enough. Moving along, it's time for today's listener question. It's from Aura.
Hi, my name's Aura, and I'm 7 years old. And I'm from Neyland, California, and I'm wondering, what's the average age of the dogs?
Hi, Aura. Thanks for the question. I'm going to be taking this one. I'm not sure what the average age is. I'm bad at math. There are a lot of dogs out there. I mean, the race has 57 teams, or it started with 57 teams anyway, and each team starts with 14 dogs, so that's something like 800 dogs. I'm bad at the math, like I said. I don't actually know how old all the dogs are either. They're all different, though. Some teams are younger. The mushers, sometimes they want to take out a younger, less experienced team to get them experienced, get more miles on them, they'll say. So they call those teams their puppy teams a lot of the time, even though they're really like a year and a half, maybe 2 years old. Not exactly cute little puppies like you might imagine, but they're puppies as far as racing in the Iditarod. They have a lot of energy, but they might not be as good at taking commands because they still have a lot of learning to do, and their bodies are still developing, so their muscles are still growing strong as they get older. Mushers talk about their dogs being in their prime when they're 4 or 5 years old. They're still really energetic, and it's after they've done a lot of racing already and built up those muscles, and they're old enough to be really strong mentally, too. The best lead dogs will be out in front of the team, and they've learned when they're old enough and practiced enough to go right when the musher says G or left when the musher says ha. Following directions gets harder, though, when they're tired or hungry, a lot like me, actually. But I think what I've heard is that the older and more experienced a dog is, sometimes it's easier for them to stay focused. Some dogs that run these long races are as old as 8 or 9 years old. We talked about 2019 Iditarod champion Pete Kaiser's dog Morrow yesterday. She's 8 years old. Pete said that he has tended to put her in the lead at the end of the race when she knows she has to get the team through the last tough stretches up the coast to Nome. That's when they're the most tired and there can be these really intense storms. So an experienced, in some cases, maybe older lead dog is super important. That's not to say that a younger dog can't lead, and we're going to hear a little bit about that in a minute. But picking the dogs that are going to run in your Iditarod team is less about the age. It really comes down to how healthy a dog is and how well trained it is. So there's a balance, and a team could have a mixture of both young and old dogs. Sometimes that mixture is really important because the younger dogs can learn from the older dogs. They kind of watch and see how they behave and kind of fall in line with the rest of the team. And, you know, that's how they get experience. They're not just learning from the musher. They've got to learn from the other dogs, too. So thank you for the great question, Aura, and thank you so much for listening to the Iditapod. Remember, folks, you can record yourself on a voice memo. Most smartphones have them. Send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Tell us who you are, where you are. If you're a kid, you're almost guaranteed to get on the podcast. Again, send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Speaking of those older dogs, it's time for today's dog profile, and that's Mask. She's a 9-year-old dog on veteran musher Wade Marr's team. Mask is mostly white, but the reason she's named Mask is that her whole face, ears, muzzle, everything is black. It really looks like she has a mask on. And Mask is actually the oldest dog on Marr's team. He talked to Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon about Mask at the ceremonial start of the Iditarod in downtown Anchorage 1 week ago today.
So this could be your last Iditarod. She's been doing it every year with me since she was a year old, and she absolutely loves to run. But Mask's personality is amazing. She loves to go to schools and visit with kids. She'll let a whole entire assembly full gym full of kids pet her and play with her, and when the last one leaves, she gets really angry and starts barking like, where did they all go? So she's a really cool dog to have, and I'm excited to take her again this year on Iditarod. So.
What number Iditarod is this for Mask?
This would be Mask's 9th Iditarod.
Oh, wow. Yep. And what position is she normally in?
She's usually in lead. She's finished in lead probably 8 of the 9 Iditarods.
Wade Marr's there talking about his dog Mask, who, like he just said, has finished the Iditarod in lead 8 of the past 9 races, which means she's been leading in some pretty tough parts of the trail since she was somewhat young. You don't always have to be an old dog to be a lead dog. As for me, I feel like I'm getting older by the minute. It's probably time to crawl out from under this table, maybe do some social distancing outside somewhere. And while we're expecting a very subdued race finish a few days from now, likely not as many people there at the finish line, if any, cheering and whatnot, we're still thinking about putting together a mix of people cheering from home. If you're out there quarantining yourself, self-isolating, etc., and you want to record yourself cheering for the Iditarod finishers, you can send that, maybe in a small clip would be helpful, just like with the questions, to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And I'll mix those together to make it sound like a crowd. That is, if the race doesn't get canceled first. Don't send me your boos, please. In any case, we'll be keeping you up to date on any developments, and we'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Iditapod. The most up-to-date information, as well as all of our race coverage, including those dog profiles and any other dog photos you might need right now, are at alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails. Pillowfort time. Okay, here we go. Gonna try to carry all these things. Bring my phone, just in case. Maybe I get trapped in the pillowfort. We're relocating from the kitchen table to a different table, going under the table. It's a large table used for projects, and it's quite heavy. It's a very thick table. I've draped a blanket over the top of it to cover the front to dampen the sound there. Crawling inside now. There's a camping pad, sort of a fold-out waffle camping pad lining one side, and some pillows, because it wouldn't really be a pillow fort without the pillows. Just now discovering I can't actually sit up all the way in here. That's great. It's dark too. This won't even work. Okay, I'm gonna use one of the pillows to just actually like lie down. And this is harder than I thought it would be. Oh boy. My legs are sticking out from under the table. And we're still taping here. Check, check, check. The trick is to do that as many times as possible. You know, I'm seeing why this might not work. Okay. Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about getting comfortable in a pillow fort.